Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mliwa Gavaza, and for today, it is a Friday, which means we sort of get into the economic news of the week. And some of the big news of the week is the 70 billion rand IMF loan, which is said to have been confirmed earlier on in the week. And we're going to be talking about that, perhaps as a way to paint a picture of what the South African economy is looking like right now, and what the country's finances look like, and what it means for you and I as we just go about our normal business on a daily basis. To sort of help us to unpack some of these issues, we are joined by Dr. Sean Muller, who is a senior lecturer at the University of Johannesburg School of Economics, and he's just going to be helping us to unpack some of these issues. Sean, good morning to you. Greetings on this Friday. How are you?
Hi, Mudiwa. I'm well, thanks. How are you?
No, we're doing all right. Thank you so much for joining us and just giving us your time on this issue. I think as a good jumping off point, you know, 70 billion rand coming in from the IMF to sort of help with the 500 billion rand stimulus package that the government committed to a few months back. How deep is this issue? Because, you know, as an ecos nerd myself, when I think about 70 billion, it sounds like a big amount of money. But when you look at it in the context of a 5 trillion rand economy, is it really that big of an issue?
Right. I think that's a good way of looking at it. On the one hand, you're right. It is a large amount of money. 70 billion is certainly significant. But at the same time, you know, even if one thinks about the national budget, which was in the region of around 1.4 trillion prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, 70 billion rand is not that much. And in particular, I think it's not large enough to be worried about us being able to repay it, which is something that a number of people have been raising as a concern. I think the bigger issue is what it signals about the state of our economy and the state of public finances. And the point being that the requests for this kind of assistance, whether from the IMF, the World Bank, the African Development Bank, or the BRICS New Development Bank, is not entirely a function of the pandemic. It's to a significant degree a function of the state of public finances prior to the pandemic and the economic consequences, both because of global lockdowns and local lockdowns, and the actual responses to the pandemic itself are what have precipitated this particular move. But it's building on a pre-existing situation where our public finances were in a very poor state.
One of my big questions has just been, is this likely to be the last such loan that we've seen? Because I think, you know, if someone is to maybe take account, this is the third so far, because I guess they have to strike that balance between domestic versus foreign borrowing.
When you say it's the third, what are the other two that you have in mind?
I'm referring to New Development Bank loan. I think that was 1 billion. Was it in May? It must have been in May, somewhere there. And then there was also the African Development Bank, which also extended some funding to the South African government, if I'm correct about these matters.
No, sure. I thought you might have been talking about the IMF only. Yes. So I mean, the thing is that this is consistent with what the Treasury said they were going to do when they announced the 500 billion rand package, and when the minister presented the special supplementary budget in Parliament. The Treasury indicated that they were planning to get about 95 billion rand from international financial institutions, including the ones that you've mentioned. So I think this is in line with that. What wasn't clear at the time was the extent to which that 95 billion was going to be raised from the different institutions. So, you know, we now know that the vast majority is going to come from the IMF, but it's not inconsistent with what National Treasury said was going to happen.
And then from there, I think A question that people might be interested to sort of know is, in terms of actually striking that balance between the foreign versus domestic, a lot of countries, a lot of people say that IMF is sort of like one of those lenders of last resort for a lot of countries because of some of the terms and conditions that they place on the loans that they do have. So why couldn't the South African government perhaps continue borrowing, you know, locally to fund its activities?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't consider myself an expert on borrowing government debt, but it's certainly something I pay quite close attention to. What was interesting for me about the IMF documents is the emphasis on the potential for a balance of payments crisis as being a justification for providing this loan. Now, my instinct is that that is something more of a technicality in the sense that the IMF has a certain set of requirements for countries to access this rapid financing instrument. South Africa had to make a case on the basis of those requirements. And whether it actually reflects a belief that we really were at risk of a balance of payments crisis is less clear to me. But, you know, even if one were to put that aside, The reality is that the rate at which the government is currently borrowing is significantly less favorable than the interest rate on this loan. So for that reason alone, it would have made sense to take it, particularly because, you know, my understanding is that the use of this particular instrument, as opposed to some other IMF funding instruments, is such that it's not really accompanied by the kinds of conditionalities that we could quite reasonably be worried about in relation to, you know, the IMF's past in implementing structural adjustment programs or forcing structural adjustment programs on developing countries that are experiencing fiscal stress. So at this point, you know, I don't really have any serious concerns about sort of this loan infringing on our sovereignty or unduly determining our economic policy decisions. And the terms seem, frankly, relatively favorable. And given that, as you pointed out at the very beginning, $70 billion is not a huge amount relative to the size of our economy, regardless really of how much it shrinks, and it's still a manageable proportion of our public finances, I think it was probably a relatively straightforward decision to make.
You know, without, you know, getting too far into the nitty-gritties, by the end of the year, according to the projections that Minister Tito Mboweni gave in his supplementary budget speech, we're likely to see the debt sitting at around 4 trillion rand or about 82% of GDP by the end of the year. Once again, that sounds like a big proportion of debt, but, you know, I feel like we always have to ask the question of, is it really that bad? Because I'm thinking about how indebted countries like the US are, and they seem to be fine.
It's a very interesting question. It's a very vexed issue. You know, I used to, in one of my previous jobs, I advised parliamentarians on public finance issues. And one of the first questions I got asked in a joint sitting of, I think it was the finance committees, finance and appropriations committees, was, why are we so worried about South Africa's debt when we've got countries like the United States and Japan that have much higher debt levels? And that was back when South Africa had a debt to GDP ratio of around 40, 45%. You know, and the answer I gave at the time was that, well, those countries get to operate by different rules. And it's a simple statement to make, but it's still one that I would hold to. So I do think, you know, that the way that developing countries interact with foreign capital markets and have to deal with sort of issues like investor confidence and so forth is quite different to what a lot of developed countries have to do, and particularly countries like the United States, whose currency is really sort of a world reserve currency, which allows them to do all kinds of things that we wouldn't be able to do. And so I find myself a bit frustrated because on the one side we have we have individuals who take overly narrow view of debt and deficits and you know, a very conservative view, which sort of suggests that one must keep them within certain parameters, regardless of how money is being spent and so forth, and regardless of the social and economic needs. And then on the other hand, so those would be the sort of the conservatives. And then on the other hand, we sort of have people who frame themselves as radicals who say, no, debt is not a problem at all. The Reserve Bank should just print money. And basically they suggest that there's no constraints there at all. And I think the truth is somewhere in between. But You know, if one looks at, for example, there's been some very good work done by people like academics like Reinhardt and Rogoff on historical economic crises. And, you know, their work was controversial because they made the mistake of claiming that they'd identified a strict threshold, which I think was about 90% debt to GDP ratio, above which, you know, countries are going to be at particular risk of crises or will experience crises. And that was misguided. And it turned out that there were problems in the actual quantitative work they'd done. But I don't think you're going to find anybody who has a substantive understanding of the historical literature who will disagree with the statement that the higher your debt to GDP ratio is, the higher the risk of a fiscal crisis of some kind. And so that's what we really need to keep in mind. You know, regardless of what the actual threshold is, and I don't believe in the existence of particular thresholds because the structure of economies and the context of public spending and so forth changes, you know, year to year and decade to decade. So I think, you know, thinking that there's a specific number that we should avoid is incorrect. But what we should be concerned about is the fact, in the South African context in particular, our debt to GDP ratio has been increasing in an unplanned way. We've kept trying to stabilize that ratio. Whatever one thinks about that objective, we've kept trying to stabilize it. We've failed. But most importantly, that the economy hasn't recovered. So the government engaged in what I would call mild countercyclical spending after the financial crisis, with the hope that in doing so, they would cushion the economy from the consequences of the crisis and allow it to recover and then make up some of that fiscal space that they'd lost. But that didn't happen. And it didn't happen for a number of reasons, partly including the dynamics of state capture. But the reality is we've ended up in a situation where we've got unprecedentedly high levels of sovereign debt. The economy already wasn't recovering. We were effectively shrinking if you think about the economy in per capita terms. So economic growth was below population growth. And then COVID came along. And the combination of what was happening internationally combined with our own policy decisions to implement a strict lockdown, which may not have been the right decision, has just dramatically worsened that situation. So I think we need to be clear that we're in a very serious situation. I think anybody who denies that or suggests that there are easy solutions to it is misguided.
I think all the things that you're touching on is, you know, a lot of the things that I've personally, you know, just been trying to wrap around in my head. On this particular show, at the start of the lockdown period, especially when the 500 billion rand stimulus was first announced, we actually spoke to a number of our guests about this debate around printing money versus not printing money, the implications, you know, why, you know, the US, is it fair, is it not fair, or what's an appropriate level of spending. But one of the things that I wanted to perhaps get your thoughts on is, what do you think the correction will be? Because markets by their nature are self-correcting, and all of this spending that we're doing in the economy, all of these things to just make sure that there's some type of consumption that's in the economy, all of that. Do you think that at some point we might see either a correction event or some correction over time? Because, you know, just the nature of, you know, economies, at some point all of this stuff is going to bubble under, and it's either going to be a big positive or a big negative.
Well, unfortunately, I think if you look at the IMF documents, I think they list about 9 potential downsides, if I recall correctly, to the Treasury's favored scenario, which is the one that the IMF effectively accepts. And then they have sort of one sentence which says, well, on the upside, if the economy recovers, you know, things will be better. But, you know, that the upside is not very convincing. So unfortunately, as much as we have to hope for the upside, if we just stare the facts in the face, the downside risks are much more significant. And so in that regard, yes, the concern would be, to use sort of the terminology that some economists use, the concern would be that with some kind of sudden stop, some kind of dramatic worsening of fiscal or economic metrics, accompanying change of sentiment, which we could be exposed to, you know, partly as a function of our well-developed financial sector and openness to international financial markets. You know, so that would be the concern there. And it's very hard to say, but it's certainly something that we have to look out for, and certainly something that the Treasury and the Reserve Bank should, and I'm sure are, paying close attention to. But I also wanted to come back to the point that you made about these discussions about printing money and so forth. I don't consider myself an expert on monetary policy, although I should say also I don't think we have many experts in South Africa. We have a few. But I've tried to really understand the arguments that are being made for printing money as a solution to the current problem. And I've really struggled to come across any coherent or substantive justification for that argument. also that takes into account the risks. This is the problem. You know, even if you propose a radical solution, there are never guaranteed solutions. So what are the downside risks? And I think that's one of the things that people who talk about a greater fiscal stimulus, fiscal expansion, or printing money never really talk about. And that's a problem. They don't talk about the possible downside risks, even if we were to accept their basic arguments, which often I don't. But what are the downside risks to what are being proposed? And to add to that, what I would say, you know, additional frustration is that I think the Reserve Bank had the opportunity to lead a discussion on alternative monetary policy prior to the pandemic. And unfortunately, what they did was they doubled down on their institutional authority, including in the business press, to basically just bat away those kinds of criticisms and leave them on the fringe. And what's now happened is that because developed countries in the pandemic have started to adopt policies which, well, whether or not they're alternative monetary policies, but they certainly come quite close to that, that's now opened up the policy space for this discussion, which is not a bad thing. But I feel like in South Africa, we've been caught a little bit flat-footed because we didn't really develop that discussion and those disagreements prior to the pandemic. And now we're having to have discussions about quite radical alternative policies at a time when things are already very bad and we don't have the luxury of taking unnecessary risks or even delaying key policy decisions. So again, you know, on the one hand, I'm sympathetic to the National Treasury and the Reserve Bank because I think they've come in for some unwarranted criticism. But at the same time, I think we have to recognize that in the past, they've relied on the institutional authority to bolster their more conservative views and shut down conversations, which now we're having to have in a much less amenable context.
I'd say that's quite an interesting take, especially when, you know, one considers how much the SARB has actually been, you know, lauded for the way that it's handled the COVID-19 crisis and sort of kept in line. I find it very good to sort of look at that other side, that there is an alternative direction that these guys could have gone on. I guess, you know, as we're rounding up, is the state of public finances at the moment, you know, could you just talk to us a little bit about, you know, some of your thoughts around that, simply because one of the big ones when it comes to this loan, one of the big talking points that seems to have really taken hold in South Africa is, one, what's the money actually going to be used for? You know, despite the fact that the minister did tell us what the stimulus is going to be used for, sort of quite pointedly, you know, with all the numbers that he gave at the time, there is still a wondering of, you know, will the money actually go to where it needs to? One, and two, how do you prioritize where the funding needs to go? And three, you know, corruption. Is the money actually going to go to the most needy, or, you know, to borrow a phrase that I heard earlier this week, are we going to find it, you know, going to Range Rover dealerships around the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think the point you made at the beginning was the right one, which is that actually this money is going to be spent precisely, you know, as any other money would be spent. My understanding is it goes, you know, it just goes into the general fiscus, and it will be spent according to the government's adjusted budget plans. So, you know, in that sense, but I think it's of course understandable that citizens are highly disillusioned with the way in which public money is being spent, you know, because we just keep seeing, you know, even under President Ramaphosa's administration, there doesn't seem to have been an end to corruption scandals or conflicts of interest and so forth. And, you know, and that's obviously very disappointing. But I don't think that has anything to do per se with the IMF money, because it is just going to go into the general pot. The other thing I wanted to say is that for myself, I prefer to think of the 500 billion rand package as more of a rescue package than a stimulus package. And I think this is also where, and I haven't gone through enough of the minister's own statements to really tell whether he's partly culpable for the misunderstanding of it as a stimulus package. But, you know, that's one of the areas where Treasury has been criticized by sort of notionally more left-wing economists who argue that the government should be doing more to stimulate the economy. Well, once you accept that the package is not actually a stimulus package, it's really trying to cushion the economy from the negative effects of the pandemic, international lockdowns and restrictions and local lockdowns. Then one sees it rather differently. So it's not surprising that there isn't actually a lot of additional spending overall. There's a lot of reallocation. There's additional borrowing, partly to compensate for the fact that, you know, we've had massive revenue under collection. There's another reallocation. You know, we're in partly a lucky situation because the UIF, the Unemployment Insurance Fund, had a massive surplus that they'd accumulated. Arguably, one could say that was actually mismanagement because they were collecting unemployment insurance contributions over and above what they were paying out. But it's worked out in our favor because we've got a cushion there that we can use to protect workers from the consequences of unemployment or, you know, and so forth. So it was never really a stimulus package. And frankly, I just don't see how we're going to have the fiscal space to engage in an economic stimulus, which means we have to look for other options. But, you know, the broader question of sort of public finances and spending and so forth, it's very difficult, again, because I think there are a lot of issues that we should have dealt with before we found ourselves in this situation. And so now we're having to deal with issues that were already important, you know, in the context of something that's really approximating, you know, if you think, I mean, Eskom, it was already in crisis and, you know, had a dual crisis, an operational crisis and a financial crisis. That's kind of gone off the radar to some degree for a lot of people because of what's going on with COVID, except when, you know, Eskom occasionally starts load shedding again. But that issue hasn't been resolved at all, you know, and prior to the pandemic, Eskom was considered by many to be perhaps the biggest threat to the stability of South Africa's public finances. And that problem keeps bubbling along with unconvincing resolutions to Eskom's financial situation. You know, in my view, the financial situation is really the core of the issue. I don't have much doubt that eventually the operational issues can be resolved. But Eskom really has more debt than it can handle. And one feels that it's going to have to be helped out in some way or form, whether through, you know, creative funding mechanisms as proposed by the unions or others. So there's no doubt there's some need for structural reform. It's almost tautological that we need structural reform because the economy hasn't been growing and public finances are worsening. So clearly we need structural reform. But what I'm concerned about is that there are a lot of things being smuggled through under the umbrella of structural reform, which I find, frankly, unconvincing. I don't think that they deal with many of the problems that we have in the economy, and particularly the problems that we have in the state. And furthermore, there's not a lot of consultation about those. So people are focusing their attention on things like the IMF loan. But let's talk about the fact that Treasury wants to introduce a transport economic regulator in the transport sector at exactly the same time that the courts just ruled against the national energy regulator in its tariff allocation to Eskom. Frankly, the National Energy Regulator has done a really poor job over the years. And whether it's their fault or partly the fault of the shareholder and the broader state is a discussion we could have separately. But the Treasury is wanting to introduce the same failed regulatory model that it's operated in telecommunications and in energy into the transport sector, where we know, as you're saying about corruption and so forth, what's the problem at PRASA? What's the problem at the passenger rail agency? It's not that there isn't price regulation. It's that there's gross mismanagement, corruption, and so forth. So, and in some cases, inadequate funding from the state. So, you know, we must also remember that you can have corruption and inadequate funding at the same time. Too often we assume corruption is associated with excessive spending, and that's not the case. So, you know, I really think we need to direct our energies towards a discussion, I'd say, about two things. The one is the structural reforms, and the other is really the government's strategy in dealing with this pandemic and moving through it. Because my own sense, and I've done, you know, a fair amount of work on this thus far, is that the government's strategy actually hasn't been clear to me from the outset in relation to how it's dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, and its lack of transparency in publishing the minutes from its ministerial advisory committee and how the National Command Council has been making decisions is really quite concerning. So let's think about the money we're getting from the international financial institutions. But as things stand, the terms we're getting that money on are pretty good, and I would suggest we should redirect our energy to the kinds of structural reforms that the IMF is talking about, only because the National Treasury is talking about the structural reforms. Those are the things we must talk about as South Africans amongst ourselves.
And then lastly, what data points have you been sort of watching during this time? Because I think for economists or anyone who analyzes the economy, it's been quite an interesting time, whether it's the slow stream of economic data, since Stats SA couldn't do its normal release of information, or, you know, people looking at Google movement data, whatever it is. But what are some of the data points that you have started looking at or have been paying attention to, you know, during these lockdown times to sort of help you to keep some type of a pulse on what's going on in the economy?
Right. I mean, I'm not an economist who tries to sort of track these regular indicators too closely, partly because I'm a little more interested in some of the structural stuff that's going on. And, you know, one gets fluctuations in survey data, which, you know, often are not that informative. But I think the other thing is that I think that a lot of the things that we're seeing in terms of the consequences for economic activity of the lockdown and so forth are almost intuitive. If you shut down sort of 70% of the economy, then you're going to shut down, you know, approximately 70% of economic activity at that particular point in time. And then as you ease up the proportion of economic activity that's being shut down, you know, economic activity will pick up. But of course, some of it won't pick up because some of those businesses will shut down and so forth. So I think that there is going to be a lot of noise. So it's great to have specific numbers. So there's this one effort to use the panel, a nationally representative panel that was originally used for a survey at the University of Cape Town and then was taken on by Stats.SA and now is being used by a sort of broader consortium to do what they hope is a nationally representative telephonic survey of households. And that's provided some interesting data recently on unemployment, on destitution and so forth, which is useful. But I have to say, I haven't seen anything coming out of that survey that's different to what I would have expected. And, you know, this has also been one of the areas where government arguably failed because it implemented the strict lockdown. Personally, I don't think that was necessarily the right decision, but if you're going to implement a strict lockdown, you have to have compensating social measures. And government really only seemed to start thinking about social protection 2 to 3 weeks after that decision. And we know it's taken quite a long time to roll out that support. And that's significant from an economic point of view as well. So, I mean, the first reason for wanting to provide additional social grants is, of course, to help people themselves. But that has implications for the economy as well, because those people will spend that money. So, you know, the government's implemented a number of useful measures, but unfortunately, like the credit guarantee scheme and so forth. But all the metrics in relation to those things, the paying out to social grants, business support and so forth, indicate that either the government hasn't been as efficient as it should have been in making those payouts, or there hasn't been the kind of take up that would have been hoped or expected. I find it useful, you know, in thinking about the pandemic and the government's response, to look at some of these international indices of there's a few of them that are being produced. There's one, a sort of a policy stringency index, which measures governments' responses to the pandemic. So in particular, the stringency of lockdowns. And so it's very, a number of researchers and others have combined a comparison of the policy stringency index with another index of government measures to provide social and economic support. In the earlier period of the pandemic, South Africa was doing, if you consider stringency to be a good thing, South Africa was doing well on the stringency index and doing very poorly on the social and economic support index. And that's slightly balanced out now because we've eased the lockdown and some of these measures as part of the rescue package have kicked in. But I think South Africa is still in a situation where our approach is relatively stringent, and either through inefficiency or lack of resources, we're not able to compensate for that as much as we would want to. So, you know, economic data will be useful to some degree when it comes in, but I don't think we actually need very detailed numbers to understand what's going on, because I think it is in many areas relatively obvious. And those numbers maybe will become useful once we start thinking of more targeted support packages. But the problem is that all of this is yet to play out. I mean, that's the thing, is that there are businesses that are surviving now, but they may not survive another 3 months. And it's pretty hard, if not impossible, to predict what that's going to look like. Similarly, in relation to businesses downsizing, you know, cutting jobs and so forth. So, you know, even if we were to have access to some kind of real-time data, a lot is going to change in the second half of the year. And so I think we need to keep our eye really on the structural dynamics and many things which are actually quite intuitive, rather than perhaps being too concerned with specific numbers.
So that was us with Dr. Sean Muller, who is a senior lecturer at the University of Johannesburg's School of Economics, and just giving us some thoughts around the IMF loan that was approved this week, about $4.3 billion or around about 70 billion rand in loans that are coming to the country as part of our foreign lending package that's meant to be part of the 500 billion rand stimulus stimulus package, and Dr. Muller is just talking about the fact that, you know, he rather looks at it as a rescue package, you know, than a stimulus package, and that's just something that people just need to be cognizant of when they're thinking about it. Also, just you know, just highlighting the state of you know, what public finances look like at the moment, we are likely to see South Africa's debt to GDP ratio increasing quite a bit by the end of the year. And he's saying that there are no definitive numbers around what's good or bad, but at the end of the day, the higher that number is, the worse off is the country, and sort of the more at risk is the country of defaulting on some of those issues. Just ending off on that point about you know, economic data, saying that a lot of what's happened in the economy is quite intuitive, obvious, because literally you switch this thing off here, it means that you know, it's gonna switch that thing off there, or you turn this on here, it's gonna turn something on there, and it's gonna have a ripple effect through the economy. So thank you so much to Dr. Muller for joining us for today's show.
This is Mudiwa's Tech.
The IMF loan to South Africa is a very interesting topic, simply because of the quantum of the loan. In isolation, it doesn't really seem like a lot of money, because if you think about the fact that you're talking about 70 trillion rand in a, you know, close to 5 trillion rand economy, it doesn't really seem like it's that much. But when you then consider it within the context that by adding, you know, all of these different amounts, because government has to fund its activities somehow. And at the moment, one of the things that we really didn't touch on in the conversation, which I think is quite important, is the fact that there is a 300 billion rand shortfall that is expected from SARS collections by the end of this year. We all know that the South African Revenue Service, or SARS, is the one that collects money on behalf of the government, and because of the downturn, they've actually predicted that we're likely to see a shortfall, or them not being able to collect as much as 300 to 400 billion rand that would normally have been collected in a normal year. And that's actually very big, because then when you think about the fact that this loan is just probably maybe about a fifth of the shortfall, then it actually paints a different picture, and it actually shows just how much money the government actually does need to be running the country and to be funding its activities. That's the first thing. The second thing to also then consider is what the money is actually going to be used for. And I think the concerns of South Africans right now, to say, are all the rands going to go to where they need to go? Because in economics, we talk about inefficiencies, and inefficiencies are things like leakages. And leakages, basically, within the context of what we're talking about right now, a leakage would be corruption. And that's an inefficiency, because it means that, one, you've had to go to an international institution to borrow, let's say, 70 billion rand, right? That's the first thing. Your interest costs, or your financing costs, are on 70 billion rand. If the country does not get 70 billion rand worth of value, that is an inefficiency, because it means that the country ends up paying for money that doesn't go for its intended use, especially if it ends up being in the pockets that it's not meant to be in. That's the second thing. But overall, you know, the big thing is, this loan is just emblematic of the fact that there's a lot of growth that just needs to happen in the economy, because in terms of paying back the money, the fastest way in which the country will be able to sort of get itself back on the right footing is if things, you know, sort of start picking up. Very intuitive, like what Dr. Muller was saying, that, you know, if you switch something off on one end, it sort of causes something else to happen on the other end. And if you think of it in that logical way, then it just makes sense that just basically growing the economy and just making sure that people are at work is the best way forward. So that's been it for today's edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter. We're #BDSpotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your podcasted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.